This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hi, it's Stephen Colbert, and I'm here to tell you about The Late Show Pod Show, which is the podcast of The Late Show with me, Stephen Colbert, and I'm here with my producer of the podcast, Becca. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Stephen.
So what do people get when they listen to The Late Show Pod Show? Let's sell this thing.
The extended moments, for sure, because we run out of time for broadcast, but we have plenty of time on the podcast.
It's kind of like being a live audience member of the show because you get things that no one else hears. Listen to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert wherever you get your podcasts.
Some families we're born into. Some families are made from the ones we meet along the way. Our families are built on love and traditions, the memories we share, and knowing that life is better because we're together. Pure Life, 100% pure quality water, refreshing every moment together. Visit PureLifeWater.com and discover where to buy Pure Life.
This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. When you want the best, you have to act fast, especially when hiring for your business. You want to find the most talented people before the competition scoops them up. And the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds top talent fast. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Spotify. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
The BBC Music Magazine Podcast.
So welcome to the BBC Music Magazine Podcast to our thousands of listeners around the world. I'm Oliver Condy, the magazine's editor, and with me today are Deputy Editor Jeremy Pound and Editorial Assistant Freya Parr.
Hello.
Hello.
So today it's turn of our November issue, which is out now, and it features on the cover the pianist Igor Levit, who has just recorded all of Beethoven's 32 piano sonatas, and we talked to him this month exclusively about that incredible project. As usual, the issue is also packed with amazing features, news, interviews, over 100 reviews, much, much more. So, without further ado, we've got a lot to talk about, and it's on with the show. A lot been happening this month in the classical music world, so we brought along just one new story each that's caught our eye. You'll find plenty more in the November issue, which, as I just said, is out now. So, come on then, Freya, what's been going on in the music world?
So, yes, another conductor appointment. I feel like it's that time of year where we so many new conductors. So we're going to kick the story off with a little clue. So that was Vaprik's 2 symphonic songs, Opus 20, and it was the first of those, Song of Mourning, and that was recorded by BBC National Orchestra of Wales under Christoph Matthias Müller on MDG. So the news from the BBC National Orchestra of Wales is that they have a new principal conductor, and it's the very young 29-year-old Californian conductor Ryan Bancroft. He's just making the rest of us seem quite
underachieving. Yeah.
So he will take over from Thomas Sondergaard in summer 2020, and Sondergaard will move on to the Royal Scottish National Orchestra.
Yes, he's. It's quite a nice story though. Behind this is that he filled in at the last minute for Zhan Yang in a tour. It was at the end of 2018. This time last year, where it was a tour of Aberystwyth, Llandudno, and Bangor. I seem to remember 3 coastal towns. And the orchestra absolutely loved him. They thought he was brilliant. And the audience, apparently audience members came up to the kind of BBC NOW management and said, make sure you take him on full time because he's brilliant. And that is what they've done.
Well, it's generally how orchestras choose their new conductors. I mean, the CBSO pretty much did it. I mean, they didn't go for one of the people who filled in, but still, you know, the sort of guest conductors, the roster that's lined up to fill in for a maestro who's departed, is a wonderful opportunity to see who clicks.
Yeah, it's a good test.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really exciting appointment, actually. You know, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales is a fine band. I mean, it doesn't necessarily go to the most glamorous of places, but it is, a fine band. And I think, to get an American, young American with lots of energy, I think will be great for it.
He's a trumpeter originally by trade. And when he was studying in Scotland, occasionally he would deputise for the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. And you'd see him in the ranks there.
Mm. Although I say they didn't go to glamorous places. They did go to Patagonia a few years ago,
that's
don't they?
Glamorous.
To visit their Welsh brethren down there.
And China recently as well.
And China, yes, indeed. So I take all that back in many ways. So let's move on to the next story. Jeremy, what have you brought to the table?
Right, well, mine's a nice little bit of fun. Recently, I headed out to the Gloucestershire countryside, literally on my bike, where I met the Armonico consort and Oz Clark, the famous wine writer and TV wine writer, wine guru.
And BBC Music Magazine contributor.
And BBC Music Magazine contributor in the past, exactly. And they have been cycling together 200 miles from Coventry down to Bournemouth on what they call the Oz and Armonico's Great Bike Adventure to raise funds to try and create choirs in schools and train up teachers to teach those choirs. They're aiming to create 300 school choirs. And so obviously it's an ongoing thing. They're aiming to raise originally £10,000. They're very close to it. They're on about £9,500. Anyway, during this tour, they would stop off at pubs on the way, lots of pubs. And when they reach pubs, they would give a little performance in each pub. I met them in a pub in Quennington, which is in South Gloucestershire, and they did a couple of bits of Monteverdi and then some Purcell, have a pint, literally a pint, not a pint of water, no energy drinks for this lot. They would have beer.
Proper pints.
Because if you've got Oz Clark with you, actually drink beer and wine. And then they'd head off again to the next one. When I was there...
Wobbling slightly.
One of them actually fell off when we were cycling.
Is that right?
Yep, one of the bases fell off, landed on his backside. And I joined them from Quennington. I went for about 4 or 5 miles because I had my son with me, so kind of we didn't go to the full thing. But they were heading off to Downampney, actually, when I was there, which is, of course, the birthplace of Vaughan Williams. And we had a nice little chat, and yes, and they actually, although the cycle ride was fun, it was over 4 days, the intention is very serious, is that they see the lack of school teachers, music teachers in schools and choirs, and that's what they want to promote.
So why Coventry to Bournemouth? Why that particular route?
Well, the Armonico consort are based in Warwick, which is just south of Coventry, so that seemed like a good place to start. And they actually started outside the cathedral there, which is good for photos. And I think it's basically because they had a friend in Bournemouth who meet them at the end and put them up and give them lots of beer. But
and it's a decent route, I imagine. They're
lovely
carved
route.
Out, not too hilly, not too flat.
No, they very, very cleverly managed to avoid the worst hilly bits of the Cotswolds. They kind of went round the flatter bits of the Cotswolds.
Unless there's a pub on the peak, in which case they...
Yes.
Shall we move on to my
yes,
story?
Please.
I think that's probably wise, actually. So this is an amusing story. Well, I think it's sort of amusing and also very serious in as much as Ian Ove decided to rescind Plus One tickets for critics coming to review their operas. And are going to use those places to train up their own critics, sort of create a sort of a future group of critics that can refresh the current roster of critics. So the idea there aren't enough young critics and Ian are going to train them up, which is fair enough. But there's been a bit of a hoo-ha on social media about critics who have suddenly lost their social connections in the evening. And find themselves having to go to the opera at ENO on their own.
It's a hardship, isn't it?
I don't have an awful lot of sympathy for the critics. I'm sorry. I see this two ways. Where I think they do have a point is that we ought to value the expertise of critics. Is that you do see some really badly written blogs, kind of have a go critics on the web, and it's when you see those that you appreciate why the newspaper critics are so good. They really know their stuff. They
didn't one of them say that they liked the other person there because they could basically chat to them about the opera and get their opinion? So it's like, well, you're getting someone else to do your work for you.
I also find that I pay much less attention. If I'm trying to host someone that's coming with me, I am often thinking, what are they thinking of it? And I'm much less in my own head than I would be if it was just
how
me.
Very
and my
empathetic of you.
Oh, that's I agree. Me.
But I agree, it was a classic example of a self-defeating argument. Yeah. They say, oh, yes, no, we must have friends so we can have their opinion. Say, well, hold it, you've just said you're the expert and the readers are relying on you.
Yeah.
So why do you need your friend then to tell you what they think? It doesn't really make sense.
I think there's a wider discussion obviously to be had about the idea of ENO choosing their own critics to review their own shows, a bit like, I suppose, a restaurant training up a critic to review its food. I mean, it's sort of, you know, I don't know whether it's sort of slightly dodgy ground, but, you know, no one's done it before, and I look to it with interest to see the people that it can produce. I just hope that the people it produce will be able to write in the same sort of fantastic way that our critics do at the moment. I mean,
and do more than just one review for ENO and then stop. We've got to see evidence that they actually move on to other things.
But that's up to the current review, the critics, to encourage them. I mean, there's a sense, I think, and there can be a sense in any kind of arty world that people guard their positions with a certain amount of sort of jealousy, and there's a reluctance to encourage people to pay it forward, as it were, to encourage people up through the ranks, and that has to happen. You know, we try and do it through our work experience programs, and I think critics need to do it by perhaps bringing along someone to the opera with them. That's where the plus one would come in handy. You know, use it wisely. Don't just use it for your chums.
That's exactly
bring along
what I thought,
someone,
yeah.
And then go over the whole process with them. You know, what am I looking for? What am I going to?
Yeah.
What am I going to write? How am I going to write it? How long does it take? How much do I get paid? Very little, I would have thought. But I mean, I think it's instead of rescinding the plus ones, maybe they should say, look, you know, encourage young people to get excited about this.
Yeah, because then they could be aided by the critics themselves and have real feedback in live time as to how the critics formulating their ideas and what they think of it. It reminded me a little bit that I think that's a brilliant idea, and actually it's a bit like the South Bank Encounter scheme where musicians bring along a newcomer to the concert hall and kind of talk them through what they think of it. And actually I think that'd be so much more effective than just, you know, young bloggers or reviewers submitting something and then I assume they get some feedback, but actually from proper established critics would be so much more valuable.
The problem is these reviews are going to be put up unedited, and I think that sort of suggests that there's not going to be, well, there will be feedback, but I think the problem with the internet is things go out and then there is no feedback.
No.
You know, with a magazine, for example, you know, we send stuff back to writers. I mean, how cruel are we? But I mean, it's important to, you know, chip away, you know, and get to the final product.
However, the bottom line, the bleating of some critics that's not having a plus one at one opera company in London is going to destroy their social life. I'm sorry, but that tells you more about the critic's social life than it does about the scheme.
It does. Right, we should move on before we get ourselves embroiled. It's time to talk about this month's mag.
This month's mag.
So don't forget our website at classical-music.com. You can read about all the latest music happenings, thousands of reviews, a good deal more. And we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and we have an iPad edition available on the App Store. So if you fancy subscribing to our print edition, we have a special discount for our wonderful podcast listeners. All of you can get 30% off every 6 issues, which takes the cost to just £25.15. You can claim the offer by visiting buysubscriptions.com/musicpodcast. That's buysubscriptions.com/musicpodcast. Right, time to talk about the cover feature, and here is a little clue. So that was the fantastic Igor Levit with the opening bars of Beethoven's Hammer Clavier Sonata. And he's talked to Rebecca Franks, our managing editor this month, about the whole process of recording Beethoven's 32 piano sonatas. And these weren't done over years. These were done in a great big sort of white heat inspiration. He's quite an incredible pianist. He's someone that doesn't do things by halves at all. Remember his earlier recordings, Rzhevsky, A People United Will Never Be Defeated, and the Goldberg Variations, and the last three Beethoven sonatas. You know, these are big works, and Igor Levit is someone I think that is a bit of a hero. He did the last three Beethoven sonatas at Wigmore Hall a couple of years ago, and decided, because the ticket sales were, you know, incredible, that he'd do two performances. So he did one early and one late. And both were sold out. You know, this is a chap who really is not afraid to scale the heights. And these Beethoven sonatas, I'm excited, I have to say.
One of the most revealing things about the interview, I won't say too much because obviously we want people to read it, but there is a lovely moment where when you see some of these extraordinary pianists in the concert hall, you imagine it all comes easy to them and these physical challenges, they just kind of hair around them and that's it. And he actually admits at one point that obviously he keeps himself to himself in the concert hall, but when he's practicing, say, the hammer clavier or the Waldstein, swear words fly all over the place. And that's when the physical difficulties really do come to the fore. And these recordings will be hard-won battles, which makes it all the more interesting.
Yes, absolutely. And I can see him getting really engaged with younger listeners as well. He's very sort of techno-savvy. So, you know, he uses the technology in interesting ways and he's very active on social media. You know, for better or for worse sometimes. He's quite a political, outspoken chap. But you know, with that comes a real artistic integrity. So it's an exciting feature to read. So we're going to move on to Jeremy. What have you brought with you from the magazine this month?
Well, no, those who know me well will know that I'm a bit of a football fan.
Are you?
I am indeed.
Tell us, please.
I will bore anyone with the exploits of Oxford United. It seems that someone who is even more a football fan than me, and to an almost nerdy extent, was Shostakovich. And there's been a wonderful new book has been published called Shostakovich and Football, Escape to Freedom. And it's all about how in some of the darkest times of his life, he would turn to football for escapism, and that you would find him at the football terraces with his mates. And this is even in this kind of 1930s when he was under the cosh from Stalin, etc. And he didn't just go and watch football. He would keep minute records of every match he saw. He was a big Zenit Leningrad fan. They weren't actually very good if you look at the figures he stored up there. They were kind of near the bottom of the table. But he got in touch with the Leningrad players, invited them around to his house. He even incorporated kind of football motifs into some of his music, including our feature by Eric Levy Reckons in the last movement of the Sixth Symphony, which we're going to hear a little bit of now. So that was Marius Jansons actually conducting the Oslo Phil on EMI in the final movement of Shostakovich's Sixth Symphony. An even more appropriate conductor actually might have been Vasily Prochenko, who actually himself is a Zenit St. Petersburg fan. And of course, Zenit St. Petersburg is what Zenit Leningrad used to be. But yes, it's a fascinating piece. And there are active ways in which Shostakovich plainly put football into his music. There's a ballet which actually has a football scene in it. But in this piece, we suggest that actually there might be other instances where his kind of escapism comes into his music, his football escapism, such in that last movement.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for us, music is a diversion. You know, music is what, well, it's our job, but for most people, it's a sort of thing that you come to at the end of the day or the weekends or the mornings or whatever. But for him, you know,
For him, it almost proved a death sentence.
Yeah.
So you can understand why he turned elsewhere for his entertainment. So.
Yes, is that why you turned to Oxford United?
Oxford United brings me nothing but misery most of the time, I should point out.
Is that equivalent of Leningrad?
That's right.
Yes, exactly. That's a fantastic feature. Eric is a huge football fan, so it's full of the
himself,
most wonderful insights.
And just to say that this whole feature was actually prompted by a wonderful new book by Dmitry Bradginsky called Shostakovich and Football, Escape to Freedom, and it is published by DSCH Publishing.
Wonderful. So we're going to move westwards and maybe a little bit northwards, perhaps on the same sort of longitude, to Scotland, Freya.
Yes, so this month we are looking ahead to St Andrew's Day, which is on the 30th of November, to celebrate the history of the music written about Scotland. And it's a place that's really been kind of taken under the wing of many composers, most of whom actually are not even Scottish. In recent years, they have been. There's Thea Musgrave, James McMillan and Judith Weir have written a huge amount about Scotland. But in history, it was actually taken on by a lot of Germans. Beethoven wrote arrangements of a lot of Scottish folk songs. And actually, it has the landscape, when you read about this, it's such an evocative landscape, and it kind of it was also so inaccessible to those beyond that actually it kind of created this sense of mystery. And in this piece, we kind of explore the kind of romantic ideals of Scotland, and you think about the rugged landscapes and the moors, that was kind of taken on in literature as well.
It's a lot of Scotland, isn't it? I mean, we forget, actually, in these days that we can just fly up and hire a car and go to the islands, that how difficult it was to get to these places. I mean, getting to Staffa for Mendelssohn for inspiration for Fingal's Cave, and the poor guy was seasick and probably didn't even see it. But, you know, it was quite a feat.
Mm. Well, even today, I was actually interviewing the conductor, John Butt, of the Dunedin Consort the other day. He lives just north of Glasgow, and he was saying, even there, he actually, in terms of how long it takes to travel, he is equidistant between London and the north coast of Scotland.
I suppose that's true.
Yes.
Yes. And we talk about the Midlands in the UK, but actually it's Manchester's midpoint between the north and the south of Britain. So, yes, that makes sense, really, the Glasgow is.
What is quite interesting about these kind of pieces which have been influenced by Scotland is a lot of it is kind of West Coast heavy. Mm. I guess that's because where you've got those big, kind of that big coastline, the sort of...
The Atlantic buffeting
the coast, etc.
I think the East Coast is not as interesting as the West. I think the West has the romance, doesn't it, really? And the midges.
And the midges as well, yes.
The romance and the midges, yes. It was the yin and the yang, you know, it gives one hand ticks with the other, but... No, fascinating piece by Malcolm Hayes, who actually lives up in Scotland.
So what would you say your favourite pieces about Scotland would be?
Well, mine's really miserable. It's a dark piece. It's The Confession of Isabel Gowdy, which is all about someone who's burned for witchcraft, effectively, in the kind of 17th century. But it's a fantastic piece by Macmillan. It's very, very powerful, especially when you know the story, which it's a tone poem. When you know the story behind it, it's very, very evocative.
Mm. I love Maxwell Davis's Orkney Wedding with Sunrise. It's wonderful.
That would be one of my favourites as well.
Great. And you?
I think it'd be the same. Yeah. Peter Maxwell Davies.
So you two are much more jolly than I am, fair enough.
Yes, although he was a northern Englishman rather than a Scotsman, but naturalised Orcadian.
And of course, the Orcadians sometimes tell you they're not Scottish as well, which makes things even more complex.
No, when the Orkney dwellers talk about the mainland, they don't talk about the mainland Scotland, they talk about mainland Orkney. I never call them the Orkneys.
No.
Never. It's always Orkney or the Orkney Islands. There we go. Tip from me. If you don't want to be chucked out of Orkney, then...
Definitely not.
There we go. Right, I think we're going to move on now to First Listen. So for those of you who don't know what First Listen is, it's a chance for us to bring to the table recordings that have rather caught our ears and we'd like to share with you. So we'd like to tell you how you can get involved actually in sharing your musical discoveries with us and your fellow readers and listeners. You can email us your choices to music@classical-music.com. And if you write a little bit about it, you could be in with a chance of being published on our Music to My Ears page in the magazine each month. So I'm going to kick off actually with this because this is rather fun. I've stumbled across a Te Deum by Bizet. Now, you know, the French in the 19th century weren't very well known for the liturgical music. I mean, Berlioz wrote a bit, Gounod wrote a bit, but mostly they were into sort of grand opera, organ music, flute music, chamber music, but liturgical music wasn't their high points. But Bizet, at the age of 20, won the Prix de Rome, and he went off to Rome and spent time at the Villa Medici and sketched out a Te Deum, which has been sort of influenced by all sorts of Italian composers from Palestrina onwards. He entered the piece for a prize, which he thought he was going to use for a trip to Naples. He was so confident this piece was going to win, but it didn't. So he fell flat on his face. But it's rather fun. It's in the sort of a grand 19th century French style, and I absolutely love it. So this is an extract from the opening movement of the Te Deum. And it's performed by the Munich Motet Choir with the Munich Symphony Orchestra under Hans Rudolf Zobeli. And it's on the Hensler Classic label. Listen to this. An extract that was the opening from Bizet's Te Deum, and that's on the Hensler Classic label. Features the Munich Motet Choir, the Munich Symphony Orchestra under Hans Rudolf Zobeli. Jeremy, what have you brought to the table?
This disc caught my eye a while back, and I was actually really surprised by it. I thought there was a danger it could be a little twee. It's called A Love Letter to Liverpool, and it's sung by Jennifer Johnston, mezzo-soprano, with Alistair Hogarth on piano for most of it. There's also contributions from the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra and Choir. And I thought it might be a selection of twee kind of arrangements of Beatles songs, The Christians, Hollies and things like that. Actually, it is a brilliantly put together song recital disc, which actually a lot of the music there is by young Liverpudlian composers. It's all beautifully sung. And it rounds off with You'll Never Walk Alone, but that's the sort of showpiece at the end of this really rather nice recital.
Yes. The label came to visit us the other day and I listened to some of it. It is wonderful.
It is brilliant. Now, the track I've chosen is Jennifer Johnston. I ought to point, Jennifer Johnston is a Scouser through and through. She's brought up in Crosby and then she still lives in Liverpool today, or close to Liverpool. I think she lives in Birkenhead rather than Liverpool.
Posho,
yeah. And one of the tracks on it is by Stephen Huff, the pianist and composer, who himself, I think, was also born on the Wirral. And it's called Madam and Her Madam. Now, check out Jennifer's command of the accent here. It's rather special.
I worked for a woman, she wasn't mean, but she had a 12-room house to clean. Had to get breakfast, dinner and supper too, then take care of her children when I got through. Wash, iron and scrub, walk the dog around. It was too much, nearly broke me down. I said, Madam, can it be? You're trying to make a pack horse out of me.
So there you go. That is A Love Letter to Liverpool.
Oh, I love it.
So great.
Yeah.
Those of us who've got family up in that neck of the woods, it really does hit home rather well. And that's Jennifer Johnston, a mezzo with Alistair Hogarth, and that is on the Rubicon label.
Fantastic. What fun. Freya, come on, let's top that.
Another fun one. We've all picked quite fun discs this week.
Yeah.
So I have chosen the new disc from Wynton Marsalis and Nicola Benedetti. They've teamed up, and Marsalis has written Nicola Benedetti a violin concerto, and this disc has that concerto as well as the fiddle dance suite on it, and she's performing with the Philadelphia Orchestra, and it's on Decca. And it's not been particularly well received, this disc, but I just think it's completely brilliant. He's used a hugely wide range of influence throughout. Kind of think how Gershwin combined jazz and classical, and then add in kind of Celtic folk, Afro-American spirituals, and you're kind of getting close to what this disc has to offer. He's written so, so well for Benedetti. Her tone and colour throughout is really rich and really vibrant. But I think the concerto is the hero of this disc. It was originally premiered in 2015, but I think has been edited quite a lot since then, because I think at the time it was criticised for length. So
He's a bit of a complete musician, is he, Wynton Marsalis?
Yeah.
I remember, you know, I wish he did more classical trumpet than he does. I mean, he does any, actually, now. I think most of his time is spent doing jazz and composing. But there was a time when he was a real star in the classical music fraternity. You know, he just can play anything.
Such talent.
Absolutely incredible. And he's the coolest man, I think, alive. I remember going to see the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra at the Barbican, and I, you know, he just counted everyone in by just grunting. And it was just, you know, the only person that could do that was Wynton Marsalis. So, should we listen to this?
Yes, so we're going to listen to the fourth movement from the Violin Concerto, and it's called Hootenanny.
Thank you.
Yes, so that was the fourth movement from Winter Marsalis's Violin Concerto, performed by Nicola Benedetti with the Philadelphia Orchestra on Decca.
Oh, what a lot of fun. Sadly, that brings us to the end of this month's podcast, actually. Our fantastic jingles were composed by Christopher Maxim. Our podcast is produced here in Bristol by Ben Newatt and Jack Bateman. So it's goodbye from me, Freya and Jeremy.
Goodbye.
Bye.
And there'll be a whole fresh new set of BBC Music Magazine team members to chat about next month's issue, the December issue. So we'll see you then. Goodbye from me.
The BBC Music Magazine podcast.